Hey, hi everybody. I appreciate the welcoming back group. I was away for 2 weeks, and for some reason there's a big crowd. I'm not sure if there was. I know there was a concert, but that wasn't here, so I'm not sure why we have so many people today. But once again, I want to wish you all a happy Yom Yerushalayim tomorrow, and. And what I want to talk about today is a thought, thank you, that is both connected to the Parsha, connected to Sfirat HaOmer, Shavuot, and Yom Yerushalayim as well. So it'll be kind of a theme that is very inclusive. And that is, we have entered, of course, the fourth Chumash, the Book of Bamidbar. By the way, as probably many of you know, whenever the Yom Tov Sheni Shel Goliot falls out on a Shabbat, in Chutz La'aretz, they're always one Parsha behind. So as a result, I missed the Kriyat HaTorah for Parshas Bechukotah, because last week I heard Bahar in Chutz La'aretz, and this week I heard Bamidbar, so that Parsha in between, which you read last week, I didn't get last week. So it's a whole problem of catch up and how you make it up. But be it as it may, at least in Eretz Yisrael, we read Parshas Bamidbar, and the Book of Bamidbar is known as the Book of Numbers in English, and in fact, that is what Chazal called it. Chazal called the Book of Bamidbar Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of Census, Sensai, if that is the plural, and that is because the beginning of the Parsha, there is a census of the generation that left Mitzrayim. And towards the end of the Sefer, in Parshas Pinchas, there will be a census of the new generation of the people that are entering the land of Israel after the old generation died out, right, in the 40th year. And you will see, interestingly enough, that the totals of the two numbers are the same, but the individual tribal calculations vary. In other words, some tribes had a net gain in population, some tribes had a net loss in population, but interestingly, without a full explanation, the totals are exactly the same. But I want to focus on the first census. The first census is the generation that left Mitzrayim, and the Torah says that census should take place on the first day of the second month, Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and that is 1 month after the Mishkan was completed. The Mishkan was completed Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the beginning of the second year, and 1 month after that they were supposed to be counted. Now Rashi raises a very interesting question. Number one, we know that there was actually another census, an undocumented census, after the sin of the golden calf, after the Chedo Egel, when Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the second Luchos on Yom Kippur. And the Jewish people were then commanded to contribute to the building of the Mishkan. So they gave half shekels, and those half shekels were melted down for the sockets of the Mishkan. But if you look at the total shekels and divide it and multiply it by two, so you know the half shekels, you actually get a population that is the same as the population that was counted only 6 months later. Now the question is, given the fact that in order to be included in the census you had to reach your 20th birthday, were there not any people that had a birthday between Yom Kippur and Rosh Chodesh Iyar? Because if anybody had a birthday between Yom Kippur and Rosh Chodesh Iyar, their 20th birthday, they should have been added in the second census. So how could the numbers be the same? Rashi asked the question, how can the numbers be the same if to qualify for the census you have to be Miben Esrim? Now one might answer, okay, there were deaths. Huh? There are people who died in between. That's a possibility. So then you'd have to posit that the births, not the births, but the people who reached 20 were equivalent to those who died. That is a possibility. And yet, the Ramban brings from different Midrashim that one of the miracles in the desert was that no one died in the desert other than the many deaths that are documented. Obviously, many, many deaths are documented in the Torah, but there were no otherwise natural deaths. So let me give you the answer that Rashi gives. Rashi gives a very fascinating answer. Rashi says that the definition of when you became a 20-year-old was not on your birthday, but rather everybody uniformly became 1 year older on Rosh Hashanah. So, for example, if you were born in the month of Elul, when Rosh Hashanah came, you were 1 year old. By the way, racehorses are aged, I believe, the same way. There's a uniform. So consequently, Rashi points out, between Yom Kippur and Eor, there is no Rosh Hashanah. So nobody had their next birthday till the next Tishrei. And as a result, the population, in terms of census eligibility, would be the same. That's a very big chiddush, that the definition of Ben Eschim Shana V'mala depended on every Rosh Hashanah you became 1 year older. First of all, that's also a little unusual, because in the Torah, the years switch in Nisan, not in Tishrei. But Rashi couldn't go with that, because between Yom Kippur and Iyar, there is a Nisan. So Rashi had to say that the uniform birthday was Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, and therefore between Yom Kippur, census number one, and census number two in Iyar, nobody became older in terms of eligibility for census. That is the answer that Rashi gives. But then there's another question, which is even more fundamental. What's the purpose of counting them 6 months apart? Bishlama, the two sensei that are in the book of Bamidbar itself, so they're different generations. One is the generation of Yotzei Mitzrayim, and the other is the new generation. But here, within a span of 6 months, you're counting the same people. What is the purpose of another census? Right, that's correct, that's correct. So Rashi says, exactly as you said, that repetitive counting is derech chiba. It's an expression of love and affection. The same way a miser might count his diamonds or count his money over and over and over again. Right? You'll see a child also count his marbles, count his whatever, his allowance money, over and over and over again. Because you treasure it so much, you just want to keep on counting it. So kavyachol, the Ribbono Shel Olam counts and recounts and recounts every time there's an excuse. So after the Chet HaEgel, Hashem counts to see how many Jews are there, and when he's going to put his Shekhinah on Am Yisrael with the Mishkan, he counts them. So Rashi learns that repetitive counting is derech chiba. Okay. But the point I want to share with you is there is a fundamental difference in the way the Jews were counted the first time and the way they were counted the second time. The first time, they anonymously gave a half a shekel. Everybody dropped a half a shekel in the pushka. Moshe and Aaron calculated the half shekels, and they knew the population. Obviously, no individual person interacted with Moshe and Aaron there. You're just counting a bunch of money. And we don't even have a tribal breakdown. The census after Yom Kippur simply tells you how many Jews there were. Actually, not how many Jews, but how many males from age 20 and up. It does not tell me Reuven, Shimon's, Yehuda's, Yisachar's. As opposed to the minyan in the book of Bamidbar. Number one, the minyan of the book of Bamidbar is tribal. Meaning, not only do we have a total, but we have the individual sums of each shevet. Number two, according to some Rishonim, the second minyan in the book of Bamidbar, in other words, the first census in the book of Bamidbar, which is the second census in the Midbar, was not through shkolim at all. People were actually counted. And even if we posit it was through a half shekel, another half shekel, but the Ramban says on the words, mispar Shemos, Mispar Shemos, the counting of names, Ramban says, perhaps Mispar could be translated not counting of names, but narration of names, that each person, when he gave the half shekel, had to introduce himself to Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, this is a quite interesting idea. If you think about it, how many Jews, even in the Midbar, had a shaychus, had a connection to Moshe Rabbeinu? You know, you wouldn't really bother, you know, if your milchik spoon got mixed in with your fleshik pot. You know, you really wouldn't go to Moshe Rabbeinu for that type of shayla. In fact, that was Yisro's point, right? Yisro's point is, you got to delegate. People can't come to you with every type of question. So the average Jew really had very little connection to Moshe Rabbeinu. In fact, imagine the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu's very face had the glow of the Shekhinah, and he had to cover his face. So he walked around with a veil over his head. And people would keep their distance, and they would stare as he would walk. He was an otherworldly figure in many, many ways. That is why, in spite of the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest prophet who ever lived, we might say, other than Adam HaRishon before the Chait, perhaps the greatest human being who ever lived. But it was Aaron who was much more a man of the people. And Aaron was actually more beloved by the average person than was Moshe Rabbeinu, because Aaron was the Ohev Shalom Verodev Shalom. Aaron was involved in the disputes between husband and wife, etc., and the like. So here's what the Ramban says. It was vitally important that at least once in your life you gave a Shalom Aleichem to Moshe Rabbeinu. It was important for you, and it was important for him that he should have a sense. Even Moshe Rabbeinu needed a sense that he's not just leading a nation, but every nation consists of individuals with their own needs and their own yearnings and their own wants and their own problems. So the point I'm making is that minyan number one through the half shekel was communal and anonymous. Minyan number two was individualistic, both in terms of tribes and in terms of actual individuals who would introduce themselves based on the idea of mispar shemot, narrating your name. So perhaps this could give us a deeper insight into why two countings were necessary within the span of 6 months. All of us know, at least we all give lip service to it, how important Achdus is, how important community is, Avas Yisrael. Although, like Mark Twain said about the weather, everybody complains about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Well, Avas Yisrael is kind of the same way. We all complain about the divisions in Am Yisrael, but unfortunately, we often do not do as much as we personally might be able to do to try to make it better. But at least intellectually, I think all of us understand how important this is. How the Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash, even though most of the Jews were keeping mitzvot, was destroyed because of the sinat chinam, the hatred and the polarization and the divisiveness. We know that Matan Torah itself, the Torah could not be given to Am Yisrael until we reach the level of what is called Ish Echad Uvalev Echad. And that's how one of the ways, not the only way, but one of the ways we prepare for Matan Torah is by trying to become people of Ish Echad Uvalev Echad. So, unity, right? Everyone is in favor, everyone should be in favor of it. It's like motherhood, and in the United States, apple pie and baseball, whatever the Israeli equivalents of that would be. Everybody's in favor of falafel, right? Everyone's in favor of falafel. Okay. Although it's fascinating how many Israeli foods are really Arabic food. Now, falafel is not a Jewish food; it's an Arab food. But nevertheless, we have incorporated it. Shawarma, same thing. Anyway, but when you focus on the notion of achdus and community, there are two types of ways communities can be formed. And I will call one way a melting pot and the other way a salad bowl. A melting pot is a concept that when you have to bring different people together that have different backgrounds, different histories, different needs, different philosophies, and you try to bring them together. There needs to be, in a melting pot hashgava, there needs to be an obliteration of differences. Kind of like, imagine a cholent on, 3 days after Shabbos. Right? So a cholent may start off with meat and barley and potatoes and beans, but by Tuesday or Wednesday, you kind of don't really know what it's made of. All of the differences turn into a glop that cannot be differentiated. In fact, somebody just told me the difference between a single boy and a married man is single boy eats cholent starting Wednesday night, Thursday, Friday. The married man eats cholent, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So one is eating before Shabbos, one is eating after Shabbos. Okay? Now, as you know, this was a struggle that Israel faced, again, and indeed to this very day, there's a great deal of animosity in the early years of the state. There was a great, great push, and again, I'm not here to condemn or to criticize, just to state the fact, a great push towards what you might even call a forced homogenization, which sometimes meant Yaldei Tehran, different in the ways in which people were put in even non-religious environments, because it was thought, again, erroneously and incorrectly, that in order to create a state, we have to have everybody on the same page. We can't have different things here and different things here, etc. In the United States, if you go back, let's say, to the big waves of immigration at the end of the 19th century and the 20th century, if you would have brought up in a New York City school in 1915 that there ought to be supplementary instruction in Spanish, they would have thought you were nuts. You come to America, you learn English. Right? Because the concept was melting pot, homogenization, make people the same. That's the only way you're going to form a community, if people give up their individuality. That is one model of community building that is called melting pot. Now, salad bowl could be what we might call, in modern terms, multiculturalism, although multiculturalism can run amok as well. And there the concept is, just like a salad, right? The beauty of a salad, you have the lettuce and tomatoes and the peppers and the chickpeas and the mushrooms and the carrots, different colors, different textures, different tastes. You mix the sweet and the sour, and they combine together to make something in which the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And you can use a lot of metaphors. You can use a gastronomic metaphor like a salad bowl. You can talk about a tapestry. The beauty of a tapestry are the different colors and the different threads. You can use a mosaic. You can use a symphony, right? Music does not really have beauty if you simply play the same note over and over again. Da, 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 da. It is precisely the different notes that combine that create beauty. And the Medrash indeed says that a garden is much more beautiful if there are different types of flowers and different types of colors. There are gardens which may only have one type of rose, and they have a beauty as well. A million red roses. But for most people, there's a greater sense of aesthetic beauty when there's kind of a diversity involved. So, consequently, one type of community is based on homogenization and sameness. And the other type of community is a celebration of individuality and the uniqueness that people bring to the mix, that the community itself grows and is strengthened by each person contributing their individual talent. Now, which type of community does the Torah endorse? Well, with Jews, we always like to say both. There are times you need one, and there are times you need the other. And this is the difference between minyan number one and minyan number two. Minyan number one, we don't talk about a Reuven, a Shimon, a Levi, Yehuda. Minyan number one, we're not interested in your giving your story to Moshe Rabbeinu. Minyan number one is about we're a single, indivisible nation of Am Yisrael in which we don't focus on individuals. Why was that necessary? Because in the aftermath of calamity, there is a state of emergency that sometimes necessitates that you put your individual agendas aside for the greater good. Think about the aftermath of the Holocaust. Right? Some of you might remember, and some of you certainly will have parents that remember, where the Jewish people were totally devastated and demoralized, losing 6 million people, losing so many Gedolim and Kedoshim, 1.5 million children. And individual people, how their whole lives were torn asunder. That was a time where we just had to rebuild. We couldn't really think about, you know, marching to our own drummer, going to our own beat, doing our own thing. When Rav Aaron Cutler came to the United States in the middle of World War II, he was already a world-famous Rosh Yeshiva. And his strongest desire was to rebuild Torah. But he put it on hold for a number of years because he had to try to save as many Jews as he could save. So Rav Aaron did not immediately become a Rosh Yeshiva. He understood that there is a time in which you put aside your fondest dreams because you have to build a nation or do what you can to build a nation. So the aftermath of the Cheder Egel was very similar. The aftermath of the Cheder Egel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, was going to destroy the Jewish people. He was going to abrogate the covenant with us and make a new covenant with Moshe Rabbeinu. And it's only Moshe Rabbeinu's fervent prayers and the tshuva of the Jewish people that gave us a second chance when Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the second tablets on Yom Kippur. And that's why Yom Kippur became the day of forgiveness. At that point, when you have to rebuild a nation after a calamity, the point is to be a little bit anonymous. It's not about you. It's not about what you want to accomplish. You got to put it on hold a little bit to build up a nation. So homogenization has a cost. Now, in a secular sense, although I think it was a totally erroneous, totally incorrect application, that was exactly the cheshbon of many in the Zionist movement back in 1948. They said, state of emergency, we got to homogenize. Now, the problem is, of course, when the homogenization is going against the Torah, you have a problem. I mean, you can't take people away from mitzvos. But the theory was, put things aside. Right? Those of you who have been in Eretz Yisrael a long time may remember those years of deprivation, of rationing, the concept in which you couldn't really, you know, buy everything you wanted to buy, or drive, or get a car, or wait, or get a telephone as soon as you wanted one. Right? There used to be waiting lists of years just to get a telephone, right? Now, the only hardship is, you know, can I get Haagen-Dazs in a, you know, in a Mahadran supermarket? But in those years, and I'm not talking about Golda Meir in the 1920s. I'm even talking about in the 50s and early 60s. You know, there were all sorts of hardships. You know, the state was being built up, and it was understood that you had to sacrifice a little bit for the benefit of creating a society. In fact, part of the malaise that is called post-Zionism is that Baruch Hashem, because of the great prosperity Hashem has given us, there is no longer this mission, this shared sense of mission, because you don't really have to sacrifice that much to live here. And although you could say that's a great bracha, but on the other hand, when you don't sacrifice, you're less connected and you're less committed to something, because you've put less of your flesh and blood in building it up. I remember years ago reading Golda Meir's autobiography. You know, Milwaukee, whole Kiev, Milwaukee, whole story. But she just describes matter-of-factly coming to Palestine, as it was called, in the 1920s, and like sleeping in ditches and mud and mosquitoes. I mean, you understand that with all of the criticism we might have of some of the Zionist leaders over the years, they were Moser Nefesh to the deepest sense to build up this country in ways that most of us cannot even imagine. So that is the idea of the melting pot. But what's interesting is the Torah considers that ideal only in the short term. You know, when you have calamitous events, when you're rebuilding, you need to put your individuality aside. But when Hashem is resting His Shekhinah on the Jewish people in a permanent relationship, He wants a community to be predicated on a recognition of the diversities and strengths of all of the different elements. Thus, in the second minyan, which represents what you might call the permanent constitution of Am Yisrael, we no longer have an anonymous Klal Yisrael. We have Ruvains and Shimons and Yehudas and Yisachars. And this raises an important point, because one might say, it's very clear in the Torah that tribal affiliation, we're not so aware of it today because we don't even know our tribes unless you're a Levi, but in the Torah, tribal affiliation is a big deal. Every tribe had its own nasi. Every tribe had its own place in the camp, their own flag. When they come to Eretz Yisrael, they're going to have distinct portions of land. Meaning, it wasn't just you were a Jew. There was a very significant idea what tribe you belong to. Now, you might wonder, why is tribal affiliation so important? Why is it important for me to be cognizant of me being a Reuven and not a Shimon, a Yisachar and not a Zebulun? Isn't it enough that we're Jews? We have to introduce another form of disunity in Klal Yisrael? And the answer is this. The Medrash teaches us that each tribe had its own unique personality and its own way of serving Hashem. That's the whole point. Hashem says, I don't want you to serve me in a homogeneous, monochromatic way. I want each tribe to develop its own individuality, its own personality. That is why in next week's Parsha, when we read about the korbanos of dedication that each of the heads of the tribes brought, and if you're a Baal Korah, although Parshas Naso is the largest, longest Parsha in the Torah, but it is fairly easy to read because the Torah repeats the korbanos 12 times, because it was brought over 12 days in Nisan, even though the korbanos are exactly the same for every Nasi. That's also the Kriyas HaTorah for Hanukkah, but now we're up to it there. Now the question is, why does the Torah repeat the same thing 12 times? Just say, Nachshon ben Aminadav of the tribe of Yehuda brought X, Y, and Z. And then you could say, and all the other Nisim brought the same thing. The Torah doesn't waste words. You got to repeat the list over and over and over and over again. Why is that so? So the Medrash tells us that there's an important lesson here. That although each Nasi brought materially the same thing, each one had unique and distinct reasons for what they did, reflecting the personality and the nature of their tribe. And therefore the Torah considers it as if the offerings were distinct, they were different, they were unique. The prism of Shvatim, which again, very sadly, we are so removed from, is that Avodat Hashem is not about sameness and conformity. It is about diversity. Now, once again, one has to be very, very careful here, because everything could be taken to an extreme. Obviously, if you simply say everybody marches to their own drummer, you don't have a religion, you don't have a Torah, you don't have a Judaism. In fact, I think I mentioned before, somebody wrote a book about religion in America, just not Judaism, just religion generally. And they interviewed a woman who was a nurse, and her name was Sheila. And Sheila said, as many people say, that she did believe in God, but she did not believe in organized religion. So she has a religion that she calls Sheilaism, which is her relationship with God. So a rabbi who read this book was talking, and he said It's very lucky her name wasn't Judy. Because then she would have had Judaism. So obviously, Judaism is not Judaism. It is not Yahadut. It is not Torah. So obviously, when we talk about the notion of diversity, inclusiveness, autonomy, individuality, we are talking about within the framework of Torah and Mitzvot, just as all of the tribes, which represent diversity and uniqueness, are all aligned around the Mishkan. Now, they're not just doing free formation. They are surrounding the Mishkan. The concept is they are like the spokes of a wheel. Right? The axle of the wheel is the Avodah Hashem. So this is the big challenge. The big challenge in life. And by the way, this plays out not only in terms of the nation, this plays out within their own families. Within the families. Is how to foster an environment in which Avodat Hashem is primary, keeping the mitzvot is what life is about, learning Torah. But at the same time, enable people to be free, to be creative, to express their ruchnius in the way that is matim to their personalities. As Shlomo HaMelech says, we've had many times, Chanoch l'nar al pi darko, train a child according to their derech. And then, Gam ki yaskin lo yasir mimenu, even when they become old, they will not depart from it, because the training was in accordance with what they are. And then to understand that it's not a question of be from, but I want you to do your own thing too. But understanding that fostering your own creativity is how you serve Hashem, how you give back to Hashem, that you give back to Hashem by developing the talents and the abilities that He gave you. Right? Because to squelch those talents and abilities, to ignore them, to be forced to give them up, that would not be a religious act. Even in the Akedah, Hashem told, what's the lesson of the Akedah? So it's, you have to be willing to even kill your son. That's lesson number one, if that's what Hashem wants. Lesson number two is, but Hashem doesn't want that. And you have to remember, there's a lesson both in Hashem's command, and there's a lesson in Hashem revoking His command. And you have to know, the revocation is also important. A Jew will do whatever Hashem wants, but Hashem ultimately does not want that kind of destruction of your children or destruction of yourself. So, without editorializing too much about how this applies to our particular communities, suffice it to say that one of the problems that we often have in religious communities is that there is such an emphasis on the conformity and on the sameness of dress and all sorts of things, that often people's individuality and people's creativity gets very, very squelched. And although the phenomenon of kids at risk is a very complicated phenomenon, and I am not suggesting at all that there is a single cause for it, because there is not, but one of the contributing causes, one of them, is that when people are not able to express that which is within them, either because the questions they ask are considered to be apikorsis, or the talents that they want to develop, whether it's music or art, are considered to be not from enough, or whatever it is. So ultimately, people will leave a system that does, two things can happen. Either they leave a system that does not allow a legitimate self-expression, or they become the living dead. One has to realize the problem of kids is not only kids off the derech. There actually is a significant problem with kids on the derech. You can have a kid, you can have a child who's perfectly good. He keeps all the rules. Doesn't do anything rebellious. But inside, there's a certain deadness a certain lack of feeling, lack of emotion, kind of a disassociation. And that, by the way, will continue into adulthood, continue into marriage, continue into parenting, assuming the person gets married and has children. Because when you forcibly amputate part of a person's personality, it's kind of like a lobotomy. You just took away something that's part of that person, and that person will never be the same. Okay, so this is kind of the ultimate lesson here, that there are times in life where you got to go for the melting pot. Set aside your dreams for the greater good of a community, but ultimately, the community of Am Yisrael is enriched. Not just the individual, the community is enriched by allowing people to develop the uniqueness of their talents. In fact, this is actually one of the benefits of the proliferation of Chozrei B'Tshuva in recent decades. We have so many people who grew up from non-religious backgrounds, and they've entered. And the truth of the matter is, they bring a lot to Am Yisrael. I mean, a lot of them have different backgrounds, which a conventionally religious person might not have been able to explore. But they bring those backgrounds, and although you could hear too, there's a lot of pressure to obliterate, make believe that, you know, they didn't have that history. And yet, one might say, it is part of the divine hashkacha that some of those things should enter Am Yisrael. So we would have kind of a richer and deeper understanding of life coming from those areas in which most of us might not have been through and the like. Okay, so these are the two models of Achdus that are implicit in the two countings of Am Yisrael. So now, let me just connect it a little bit to Sfiras HaOmer and then to Yom Yerushalayim itself. Sfiras HaOmer is the period of time where we connect ourselves to Matan Torah, right? We're connecting. Sfiras HaOmer is actually a linkage between Pesach, which is the holiday of freedom, and Shavuos, that is the holiday of Torah and commitment to God. And the central lesson is that freedom without Torah is meaningless. That is why the grain offering of Pesach is Omer, which is barley. Barley is animal fodder, or was animal fodder. The grain offering of Shavuos is wheat, which is human consumption, because freedom without submission to Hashem is animal liberation. It is only with submission to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it becomes true human freedom. I mentioned it probably more than once, the poet Tagore's metaphor that a human soul is like a violin string that is capable of beautiful music, but only when the string is tied down. When the string is loose on the table, it can make no noise at all. When you're totally free, nothing comes out. When you tie yourself down, then there's a beautiful music. That's a perfect metaphor to understand counting of the Omer, linking Pesach and Shavuos. So one would expect that the things we think about are to intensify our religious commitment, our Torah learning, our meticulousness in halacha. If there are areas in Jewish law that we're not as conscientious as we should be, whether it's the laws of Shabbos, the laws of Kashrus, davening on time, davening with the minyan, this is the time to strengthen yourself. We're makabel Hashem's Torah, naseh v'nishma. And yet, at the same time, we know that the period of the Omer is also a period of sadness and mourning. Again, some people until Lag BaOmer, some people after. Because this commemorates the time of year when the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva died. And although people say, well, 24,000, that's a very bad thing, but unfortunately, we've had worse. Why are we making centuries and centuries observing the deaths of 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva if we don't even have an official, certainly not a rabbinic commemoration of the Holocaust? We have Yom HaShoah, but that's not in the religious calendar per se. But you have to understand, though, that the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva were the teachers of Torah for the next generation. And Rabbi Akiva only had 5 survivors. Meaning to say, it was even worse than the Holocaust in that sense. The whole perpetuation of Torah was hanging on the tiniest and thinnest of threads. And had there been no teachers of Torah, that would have been the end. That would have been the end of the Jewish people. So in a sense, the devastation was even greater. But be it as it may, what's more important is not the fact that they died, but that the Gemara tells us why they died. They died because they did not show proper kavod, zelazeh. They did not show proper honor and respect to each other. Rav Shimshon of Father Hirsch explains that kavod comes from the word kaved, which means heaviness. Kavod is not about being polite to somebody. We can assume the students of Rabbi Akiva were polite. I mean, they weren't acting like coarse people. But kavod is when you look at somebody and you see them as weighty, as significant. You see their dignity. You see what they contribute. You value them. You see, you can be nice to somebody out of a sense of compassion. Ah, Nebuch, the person is a nobody, but I'll be nice. Noblesse oblige. Kavod is not that. Kavod is when you look at a person and you see them as weighty and significant. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz even says, the mitzvah of kibud avim, the 5th commandment, honoring your parents, he says, it's a very interesting point, that's not brought down in the Rishonim, but he says it as a svara, is not only about being nice to them, it's about identifying in your parents qualities that are worthy of emulation and admiration. You have not fulfilled kibud avim in its fullest sense until you can tell yourself what I admire about my parents, religious or not. Now, Baruch Hashem, for most of us, that usually is not a big problem. Most of us can readily identify. But some people may have problems, right? Parents may be difficult. Even then, Abraham Lincoln once said, generally, he said he didn't like a certain person. I really don't like this person. And then he went on and said, I guess I don't know him well enough. You know, there's a saying, people who hurt, hurt. Which means, when people hurt others, it's because they're hurting. So, when you go back, just an example, parents were difficult. But you go back and kind of think about their life and what they went through. And the difficulties they faced. And they still managed, let's say, to go to work every day and whatever it would be. Then a lot of times, even the resentments we have can turn into compassion and even love and admiration for the fact that they had a real hard time and they still did as good as they managed to do. You know, the things that make us upset when we're younger, again, I'm not addressing every single case, obviously there are going to be extreme cases, but very, very often the things that make us angry, we can have a whole different perspective of kavod. So, it turns out the following. If we ask ourselves, what is our avoda during Sfiras HaOmer? It's 2 different avodos. Avoda number 1, strengthen ourselves in Torah and mitzvos. Avoda number 2, see the kavod, the significance, the gravitas, the worthiness and the weightiness of the other. These are 2 different things. One comes from the preparation for Matan Torah, and the other comes from the mourning over the students of Rabbi Akiva. In the polarized world that we live in, we often find that people who excel in one are almost inevitably going to be deficient in the other. We often find in our own lives, as we get more passionate, more fervent, more fervent, more fiery, we tend to look down at others who we think are not as religious as us, not as good as us, not as close to Hashem as we like to pride ourselves as being. And then the other way around, people who are tolerant, inclusive, loving, and open, they may be a little mushy about halacha. I'm okay, you're okay. Gay rights, gay marriage, abortion, everything's good. Everything's good. Everybody should have the right to express themselves. Svira Sa'omer is telling us that this is not an all or nothing. This is not one or the other. You got to do both. And that's the great challenge in our family life, and it's a challenge in our educational systems. How do you create a culture, that's the right word, a culture of passion and fire and commitment to truth, and at the same time foster an appreciation of every Jew, really every person, but certainly every Jew, in terms of what they do for Am Yisrael? One can look at the Chayolim, even not religious, and appreciate their sacrifices, the police and the fire and the garbage trucks, whatever it is. That whatever religious Jews are able to accomplish is only because of an infrastructure that has all of these things, in which every person is valued and every person is respected. And at the same time, we are fiery and passionate in our Yiddishkeit. And of course, the answer is actually relatively simple, and that is, when you want to be passionate about the Torah, include in your passion those parts of the Torah that talk about Ahavat Yisrael. That's also part of the Torah. If I want to be passionate about Shabbos and Kashrus, I want to be passionate about V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. So yeah, be passionate. Be fanatic. But if you're fanatic about Shabbos, and I say that in a positive way, not in a negative way, then be equally fanatic about V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. So, if you're a true fanatic, that's wonderful. Be fanatic about everything. Don't pick and choose. How can a Jew who believes the Torah comes from God pick and choose what they want to be fanatic about? Right? So that's kind of the lesson. So finally, coming to Yom Yerushalayim, again, I just want to make the same point in terms of the historic fact that our beloved city is Lahavdil, like Minneapolis, St. Paul. Yerushalayim is actually two cities in one, and I don't mean east and west, and I don't even mean heavenly and earthly, although that is definitely true. But originally, the original name of the city was Shalem, Salem in English, Shalem. And we find that even in Avraham Avinu's time, Shalem was a special city. We talk Malchit Tzedek. That's Shem, Ben Noach, but Machir, the king of righteousness, the king of Shalem. So this was known to be a holy, special place. But it was only called Shalem. So where do you get the Yeru? The Temple Mount, when Avraham Avinu was commanded to sacrifice Yitzchak on Mount Moriah, Har HaMoriah, Avraham Avinu called the mountain, the Temple Mount, what became a Temple Mount later, Hashem Yireh. God will see, God will look down at his people, Yireh. So it turns out, the Temple Mount was called Yireh, the rest of the city was called Shalem, Yireh Shalem, right? Yireh Shalem, but the Aleph and the Hay got combined to a Vav, because Aleph and Hay is Begematria 6, so Yireh Shalem became Yerushalem. Now, not Layim yet. And that's very close to the English. Jerusalem. And indeed, in Tanakh, although we read the word Yerushalayim, it is commonly spelled without a yud at the end. In other words, it's the letters Yerushalem. So why do you get Yerushalayim? So that, the Medrash says, that just like Yadayim are two hands and Raglayim are two feet, Yerushalayim are two Jerusalems, earthly and heavenly. And they are in alignment. Right? But this is two cities, Yireh and Shalem. Now, Yireh in its context clearly means he will see, Hashem Yireh, Hashem will look down. However, the Medrash on a play of words points out that Yireh is the same words as Yireh, fear of God, reverence. So consequently, the Medrash is willing to say Yireh also refers to fear and reverence of Hashem. So now it turns out, therefore, that the two names of the city based on the Medrash are fear of God and peace. Yireh and Shalom. Now once again, you see how those two ideas can be a perpetual source of conflict. Because often when there's fear of God, there will be a certain intolerance. We're going to have passion, we're going to revolt, we're going to protest. When there's Shalom, there might be a weakening of the fear of God. But once again, the same way the counting of the Omer says, your passion of Torah cannot be at the expense of the kavod you have for others, nor can the kavod you have for others diminish your passion for Torah. This very city's name beckons us to the message that in a life committed to Yirat Hashem must also be a life that is committed to Shalom. And a life that's committed to Shalom must be committed to Yireh as well. That these are not two opposite phenomena that often exist in the world as we see them, but rather they have to be integrated, they have to be synthesized. So again, I wish you all a Chag Sameach, and we should all be well.